interesting about these two theories is that what they explain the worst sorts of jokes. The superiority theory explains racist, sexist jokes, jokes that are hostile toward other people. And Freud's sex theory or release theory explains lewd, naughty jokes. But there's another kind of joke that's just pure, wonderful nonsense. And I think this is the highest form of joke telling. A good example, this actually comes from public radio. I was listening to a classical broadcast a few years ago, and after a piece of music was finished, the announcer came on and he said, why is it so hard to find the composer of the Surprise Symphony? Why is it so hard to find the composer of the Surprise Symphony? And I was racking my brain to what bit of music history could he be alluding to. And then he said, because he's hiding. Okay, this is, I think, you don't like any of this material. But what's wonderful about this, there's no hostility to it. There's no superiority. There's no naughtiness. It's just pure wordplay. And so there's a third theory of humor called the incongruity theory that explains this kind of humor. That says that we laugh when things that are in completely different compartments of the mind suddenly and unexpectedly get yanked together. And so in the setup, there's something weird and incongruous, and suddenly there's a little twist, and in the punchline, it gets resolved, and it just seems trivial. And so why do we laugh? Well, to explain that, we have to go a little bit back into prehistory. And imagine you're with a band of hominids, and you're out hunting, or you're out sort of moving through the jungle, and you encounter something that looks to be a threat, something that's a little off, maybe another band of hominids in the distance, or maybe something that looks like a snake hanging down from a tree. And so the group goes into a fight or flight mode, suddenly tenses up. But then somebody in the group notices, oh, wait a minute, this isn't a snake at all, it's just a bit of vegetation hanging down from a tree. Or, wait a minute, this isn't this group of hominids off in the distance, they're actually our kinfolk, they're not a threat at all. And so when he or she discovers that, he emits this sort of stereotype vocalization, which is laughter, and communicates it to the other members of the group. And so laughter not only communicates that what the apparent threat, the apparent menace, is actually trivial, it's a big nothing, but it also, it's contagious, so the word automatically spreads through the group. So this is, I think, this is a very speculative theory of laughter, but it's the best one I've heard. It's called the false alarm theory. And it works very well for jokes, because what is a joke? There's something in the setup that's a little bit weird and disquieting, like to allude to the previous joke, why is it so hard to find the composer of the Surprise Symphony? That's a kind of weird thing to ask, and I was, what is this guy talking about? And then suddenly there's a twist, and everything gets reinterpreted, and it turns out to be totally trivial. So the something that made you a little tense as you try to figure out what it was turns into nothing. And this is, one good function of jokes is they're a way of trivializing things that are genuinely disturbing, like, that's why we have jokes about sex and about death and so forth. Gallows humor is a way of doing that. So so these are the three theories of humor, and it seems to me that any good, that most jokes have ingredients from all three. There might be a little bit of sexual naughtiness, a little bit of hostility toward an out-group or somebody who's made fun of, but also just a bit of pure, wonderful incongruity or nonsense. And so I like to think that there's a evolutionary progress in joke telling, that the earliest jokes were all about lewdness and nastiness and aggression. And with the course of civilization, the joke telling gets more and more refined, it gets more and more intellectual, and, until it's simply, nonsense. And there's nothing more intellectually beautiful, I think, than nonsense and incongruity.
Well, yeah, we like to...
That's a Shaggy Dog story, isn't it?
Well, there you go.
Without a punchline. Sorry about that.
We try to bring the whole inventory here at Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm going to give the phone numbers again. I understand we had some network issues there for a moment or two, and some people may have missed when I gave the phone numbers earlier. 800-486-8655 is a toll-free number that you can use to join our humorous discussion of jokes. 800-486-8655, 227-2050, please, if you're calling us from Milwaukee, 227-2050. You can also reach us via the Internet. The address is talk@wpr.org. Well, different parts of the world seem to have different styles of humor. People talk about British humor as being having some really unique aspects to it, and there are certainly other parts of the world that have their own styles of humor. I'm imagining then that you would agree that humor is really based on your culture in terms of what's funny.
Yeah, but in a way, though, you know, anthropologists will always tell you that different cultures are telling the same jokes in slightly different guises. In the United States, we used to tell jokes about Poles, so-called Polak jokes, and certain racist jokes, although we don't tell them much anymore, which is a good bit of moral progress. In France, exactly the same or very similar jokes are told, but they're told about Belgians. So you have the same logical form of the joke, but the group that's made fun of is different. And a lot of these jokes that I found in ancient joke collections and Renaissance joke collections, you know, turn up on television shows today. I was watching the show Curb Your Enthusiasm, which I love, with Larry David, and one of the jokes from the Renaissance collection that I told you about earlier turned up in almost exactly the same form. He's in. I think I can tell this on the air. He's in bed with his wife Cheryl. And she says, Cheryl says, Larry, why is it that when we have sex, I'm always the one who has to initiate it? And Larry says, well, you know, because we men are always always in the mood. You just tap me on the shoulder when you want it. This exact same joke was in the collection that this papal secretary had put together in the 14th century. But then, of course, they're completely fresh and new jokes. I was at Lily Tomlin was giving a one-woman show on Broadway years ago, and I remember her saying, when I was young, I always wanted to be somebody. Now I wish I had been more specific. I know this is utterly original and the most intellectual joke I've ever heard, but I thought very funny.
Well, I guess what I was referring to earlier, though, if, for example, the classic British joke is one man says to the other, "I'm sorry to hear that you buried your wife." And he says, had to, did you know? And, I mean, that's the classic British wit.
Uh-huh, yes.
Leaving Benny Hill out of it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the British wit, they have a lot more material to work with because they have this very complicated class system, which still exists. It's not quite as obvious as it used to be. But, you know, the class system has all kinds of absurdities built into it. And also, the British humor tends to be more laconic. It tends to involve fewer words because, you know, the British in the 19th century and early 20th century British visitors to America always said Americans produce so much verbiage when they talk. They use so many more syllables to say things because, you know, maybe it's because they have this sort of vast space and they want to fill it up with words. And so the joke you just told is a good example of that. It's the fewest possible words, and that's why it's funnier. By the way, I've often wondered what the shortest possible joke might be. It would seem to have at least two words because you need a setup and a punchline. And so, for about a year and a half, I was in search of a two-word joke, and I asked everyone I knew, and no one could come up with one. And then finally, I discovered it, and it's pretentious. Moi. Ooh. The good thing about that is if your audience doesn't laugh, you can accuse them of not knowing French. The only thing worse than being accused of not having a sense of humor is being accused of not knowing French. Or maybe that's not true in Wisconsin.
Or not knowing the definition of the word pretentious. And I'm just not going there. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's the toll-free number you can use to call in. If you've got a question about jokes, maybe you've got a joke you'd like to tell us. Keep it clean and short. 800-486-8655, 227-2050. What makes you laugh? And why do you think that is? What are the things you think are funny? One of the things that you talk about in the book is there's a sinister aspect to things that are fairly innocent, like the elephant joke, which was very popular in the 60s. There was a subtext there. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, this had never occurred to me. I went to Berkeley, California, to talk to a man named Alan Dundies, who was known as the joke professor at Berkeley. He's an anthropologist. And he was a great collector of jokes, and he produced many scholarly treatises on jokes, and he collected jokes about the Soviet Union and jokes about horrible jokes from Germany that were told by people who were nostalgic for the Third Reich, jokes about the Nazi death camps and so forth. And these, obviously, that category, extremely objectionable and ignoble. But then he was quite interested in elephant jokes, and he took a Freudian psychoanalytic approach to jokes, and he said, you know, elephant jokes became popular, as you said, in the 1960s when integration, when the civil rights legislation was being signed by LBJ, and when integration was taking place, and he said they reflect the sort of white anxieties about black people. And this struck me as really a little ridiculous, I have to say. And so he said, well, let me give you an example. Well, you know, then, but you know, the idea that elephants live in jungles and they, you know, associated with violence and sort of other, you know, alleged analogies with either, with, you know, stereotyped views about black people at the time. And so at least he said, let me give you an example. The joke, why did the elephant sit in the marshmallow? The punchline is, so he wouldn't fall into the cocoa. You know, it seems the most innocent, childlike joke imaginable. He said, no. It's not so innocent. It reflects the white anxieties about blacks moving into their neighborhood. So the white marshmallow is the white neighborhood, and the cocoa is the surrounding sort of black area. And it's about the aspiration of black people to move into white neighborhoods. And I thought, you know, this is really a little bit too subtle for me. I'm not sure I believe that. And he said, I have a psychiatrist friend who asked his secretary, who was African-American, if she knew any elephant jokes. And her response was, you know, why would we tell them? They're about us. It makes sense that you know, even jokes about... you know, a good example now is Barack Obama. People say that, you know, in a sense he's joke-proof because there's nothing ridiculous about him, except perhaps his, you know, his slightly large ears. But he's, you know, wonderfully articulate. He's witty. He doesn't trip over his words the way George Bush and his father did. He's in control of his libido, unlike Bill Clinton. So he's really joke-proof. And on top of that, he's the first African-American presidential candidate. So in a way, we don't want to joke about him because we have this legacy of racism and, you know, and racist humor. And it just doesn't seem appropriate to use that horrible word. And so, of course, The New Yorker, for which I write, had the notorious cover last week that showed, you know, Obama and his wife in the Oval Office. He was dressed as a Muslim, and she was dressed as a Black Panther, and there was a picture of Osama bin Laden over the fireplace, and American flag burning in the fireplace. And this was meant to be satire, but it got everyone very, very upset. And then people began wondering: is there a joke we can tell about Barack Obama? The only good one I've heard is: have you heard that Barack Obama has fathered two black children? Which sort of, you know, gets at the ridiculousness of some of the you know, the smear campaign rumors against him. And then, of course, people have been inventing approved Barack Obama jokes. One that I rather like is a Christian, a Jew, and Barack Obama were in a boat at sea, and Obama says, "This isn't going to work. There's no Muslim in the boat." Or. A Barack Obama drives up in a convertible to a gas station, and there's a a zebra sitting in the passenger seat next to Obama. And the attendant comes out and says, we don't see many zebras around here. And Obama says, I'm not surprised at these gas prices. We must end our dependence on foreign oil. You're too kind.
You know, I should have put a button on the computer with a rim shot on it. I could have just
By the way,
hit
these
that.
These so-called approved Obama jokes were made up by Andy Borowitz. I should give him credit.
Okay. Let's take a call from Catherine in Rhinelander. Catherine, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling to bring up the subject of, and Lena says the Oli kinds of jokes from UP, red-green kinds of jokes. They're a tremendous source of humor for people who live in the northern part of Wisconsin and Minnesota and UP, but a lot of people find them very flat and very like, huh, what did you just say? And I have a wonderful book that was written by in a scholarly way by somebody in Madison, UW-Madison, excuse me, I'm making turns here, I shouldn't be talking on the phone right now. At any rate, the man takes a lot of this humor and puts them into historical perspective and shows the basis. Some of them come as far back as Aesop's fables, the reason that the jokes exist and the way that they came about. It's a wonderful book. But the UP humor, I've tried to tell these jokes, maybe it's my timing, but I can't tell them to my children who live in other parts of the United States and to other people. They just don't find them funny.
What's an UP joke?
The UP refers to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Yes.
And it's been sort of given an almost an ethnic status all its own, and the another similar area to that would be in Minnesota, the Iron Range. In where I'm from, people tell ranger jokes about people from the Iron Range, and in northern Wisconsin, Upper Peninsula of Michigan is fair game, and so we tell jokes about the so-called youpers and the way they talk or how they dress, the kinds of things they're interested in, and oftentimes they become Finlander jokes.
Yes, also Finnish because, or Polish
yeah,
or all the people
right.
that settled here, Swedish. A lot of Swedish
Norwegians. Yeah, it's ethnic humor, but it's given a geographical basis, and because of the unique aspects of the Upper Peninsula, there are far more trees than there are people.
Well, but life is so harsh here, and a lot of people came here and had to deal with very deadly kinds of occupations, such as the logging industry, and they were poor, and it was harsh, and the winters were long, and so the jokes developed out of all of that kind of life, from the what happened in bed to making the children to what happened in the bars, and they're amazing jokes, but they have such a foundation in storytelling. Anyway, it's an interesting thing to bring up in your joke telling hour.
Thank you for that, Catherine, and I want. We'll continue the discussion. We're late to get to a break. I need to get this in, and we'll come back and take some more of your phone calls at 800-486-8655 and 227-2050. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 1047. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. Here is what's coming up next hour with Larry Mueller. The state black bear population is now thought to be much greater than earlier estimates. After 11, Larry Mueller talks about bears in Wisconsin with DNR bear and deer ecologist Keith Warnke. That's coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about humor. And the genesis of this program is the publication of a new book titled Stop Me If You've Heard This, A History and Philosophy of Jokes by Jim Holt, published by Norton. And we have the author of the book with us to talk to you, and a lot of people want to do that. The lines are full right now, so let's go back to the phones. Well, first of all, I will go back to what Catherine, our previous caller, had to say. She was talking about the regional humor of northern Wisconsin and making fun of people from the Upper Peninsula and coming out of kind of the hard times that immigrants had when they came to this country and the storytelling tradition and so forth. Do you care to comment on that before we move on?
I was hoping you could tell me one really good Upper Peninsula joke. Do you have one off the top of your head?
Boy, let's see.
What do you, one or well, one about yeah, the, what do you, the Iron Range? Was it the Iron Range that you mentioned?
Well, the Iron Range or the UP, what do you call someone from the 14-year-old from the Iron Range in the third grade?
Give up.
A genius. you know, and substitute Norwegian, Polish, German, you know, Finlander, whatever, Uper. Well, there's one, fellow from the copper country of Upper Michigan goes to Hawaii, and he gets off the plane, and a woman comes forth with the flowers, puts around his neck, and she says, "Aloha from Hawaii," and he sticks out his hand and says, "Mackie, copper country." My mother used to get a big laugh out of that one. And anybody who knows copper country would probably share that. Yeah.
This I like that one.
Yeah, well, thank you.
I don't know why I'm laughing so much. It wasn't that funny, but...
well, no, it wasn't.
Good delivery,
so.
I guess.
Yeah, it's timing. It's a gift. What can I say? Let's go to Eric in Madison. Eric is next. Go ahead.
Hi, yeah, I had a question about what we said earlier about humor evolving. I was wondering, to what degree, what you're basing that on, because, I look at, the kind of humor that pervades in our society today. We've got, pretty intellectual humor like Curb Your Enthusiasm, and then you've got, pretty body humor like MTV Jackass. And I think if you put that alongside, the humor from a couple hundred years ago, look at, Henry Fielding, or Joseph Andrews, and you see, how he uses the idea of the affectation and the ridiculousness, and as well as having the body humor as well. And you have Punch and Judy, and given the social context, I think it could easily compete with what we've got here. So, I guess I'm just curious about how you see it evolving. Because as long as potty humor is funny to 10-year-old, I fail to see how. In a more intellectual humor is going to kind of come into fruition.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, I mean, one interesting thing is that you don't see, take the term wit, for example. Originally, wit simply meant, general intelligence. And then in the 19th century, when the idea of humor being about something other than making fun of people or making sexual insinuations came to the fore. Wit came to mean something like seeing resemblances or connections between ideas. And then finally, by the end of the 19th century, the main meaning of wit was an ability to take delight in sort of absurd resemblances. Which would be the essence of the best kind of joke. But you really don't. You see this sort of emergence of humor. Take Aristotle and Plato. Plato thought that the object of humor was the ugly, and Aristotle thought that humor was about vice. You laugh at people who have some sort of vice to correct them. It's a kind of mockery. The idea of humor as nonsense was fairly alien to them. And so, but you do see that emerging, prickly in the 19th century. That may have something to do with the Victorian era when bourgeois respectability became a great value, and a lot of the really dirty humor had to go underground. If you look at in England in the 18th century, everyone told bawdy jokes right up to the royalty, and in the 19th century, with the coming of the Victorian era, when you had the rise of the middle class, suddenly respectability was important. We don't tell jokes like that. By the way, there was this man named Gershon Legman who was absolutely fascinating. I discovered an American who came out of the western Pennsylvania. His father was a kosher butcher and came to New York and became a scholar of dirty jokes, among many, many other things. He was an amateur psychoanalyst. He worked for Alfred Kinsey, the sexologist. He actually coined the expression, "make love, not war," brought origami to the West, and so on and so forth. But he was mainly interested in collecting dirty jokes, and he compiled two enormous volumes of them. The Rationale of the Dirty Joke is the title of the first one, and they're both, 600 pages. And he was not interested in them so much as, material for locker room jesting, but he wanted to collect them because he thought that they expressed the forbidden impulses of a civilization, and that somebody had to write these down. He said this is the deepest subcellar of the Alexandrian Library, a cauldron of improper impulses that are encoded in these jokes. So anyway, when I read through these volumes, I found it to be pretty punishing. I really didn't enjoy it at all. But I think that, I'm sort of evading the question of the caller, which is a very good one. But it's interesting, if you want to see what jokes are going to look like in the distant future, a good way of getting an idea is to go back to the very distant past, because things that have been around for a long time tend to stay around for a long time, and fairly new things tend to disappear. This is based on something called the Copernican principle, which I would urge everyone to Google when they go back to their computers. So what did chimpanzees find funny? Chimps actually engage in something like laughter. It's twice as fast as human laughter, but it's recognizably laughter. And they have a concept of funny because you can teach chimps sign language, and they can sign funny, and they actually find certain things funny and will sign funny. And one thing that a chimp finds funny, Washo, the chimp that was trained by Roger Fouts, thought it was really funny to present a rock to the researcher and call it food, for example. Or another one called Moja, a female chimp, would take a purse and call it a shoe and try to put it on her foot. So what chimps seem to find funny is misnaming or misusing objects. And that's pure incongruity. It's a fairly primitive kind of incongruity, but it's pure absurdity. There's nothing of smacking of sexual repression in it. There's nothing about hostility. And so, I think this is the original essence of humor. And when you have civilization, that's when you get, I define civilization as cities plus writing plus sexual repression. And that's when you get the possibility of lewd jokes, of the kind of jokes that Freud was tried to explain. And also you have in-groups and out-groups, so you jokes making fun of other people come with civilization. And so I think, in the fullness of time, sexual repression and in-groups and out-groups will fade away, and our descendants a million years from now will enjoy, pure incongruity, pure absurdity, just because it contradicts logic, and what's more fun than that?
Anyone Eric, thanks there? For the call. thanks for the call. Eric, let's take a quick call from Nancy in Delavan, and we're almost out of time. Nancy, go ahead.
Hi. I'm surprised quite often about how people don't know the answers to really simplistic jokes, things that you would think would be obvious because they're like children's jokes. I know one particular joke in its entirety and no other jokes that I can remember, and it goes, why did the lion spit out the clown? Because he tasted funny. I mean, it's really very simplistic, and every time I tell it, there is no answer. I think one child answered me correctly once. But no adults. It's amazing.
I like the fact that the caller identified herself as a woman of one joke, and I think if you know one joke, that's not a bad one. Jokes are highly intellectual, and a joke involves there's something weird about the setup, and then there's this paralogical twist, and everything is reinterpreted in the punchline, and so. It takes a great deal of cleverness even to get to get a joke is not that hard, but to see it coming. I mean, the whole point of a joke is that the hidden meaning is disguised until the very end, and you think, wait a minute, there's something here. The lion spitting out the clown, that's a slightly disquieting image, and you can't help but think about it analytically. Then suddenly the teller pulls the rug out from under you, and you're left hanging. And that's the beauty of the art of joke making is you get your audience out there, and then suddenly the floor drops out from underneath them. And
why don't sharks eat lawyers? Professional courtesy. Each era has its own jokes, and I wish we had more time to talk about them. We could do blonde jokes, lawyer jokes. I mean, it's endless. But we're out of time, and so I'll say so long, and thank you very much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The book is Stop Me If You've Heard This, A History and Philosophy of Jokes, published by Norton and written by Jim Holt. And That's all we have to say about that. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning, and John Anderson answered the phones. If you'd like a copy of it, you can get one from the radio store and ask for program 723E. The phone number is 800-747-7444. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today, and you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.